Okay.
Hey, verify ABA circuit breaker configuration.
Apollo Control Houston with Ed Mitchell, Al Shepard back in Antares.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Stu Russo and Kitty Hawk has completed a second run of Descartes photography.
Yep, that's that one.
This task accomplished at 136 hours, 21 minutes. Again, for this pass, Russo used the 500-millimeter Hasselblad camera.
It's a real picture. Okay, good. Okay, close the LGC pump breaker. LGC pump breaker is closed. Okay, push now both to O and connect to the... Hey, wait a minute, are you? Both do it together.
Yeah.
Both set up our panels alike.
Yep.
And we'll dock and set it up, set it up.
Okay.
Okay? Point O.
Go ahead, Antares.
Okay, we're on spacecraft.com now. We're proceeding with the Bliss OPS docking, I should say.
Roger. Antares, Houston.
Okay, Ed, we want to check SN02 pressure here before you get your gloves on to repress. So would you give us a call prior to donning your gloves?
This is Apollo Control, Houston. We're at 136 hours of 49 minutes, ground elapsed time. The crew aboard Antares, very quiet at present. They're going through their flight plan items prior to depressurizing Antares again, opening the hatch again and throwing to the lunar surface the disposable container and the portable life support systems, the backpacks. We're at 136 hours, 50 minutes, continuing to monitor. This is Apollo Control, Houston.
Houston, we're getting ready to don gloves.
Okay, and Al, before you put your gloves on, I wonder if we could make this SN02 check. Now, you ready to go?
Tell me what you want.
Okay, we'd like descent O2 closed, bliss fill open, and ascent 1 oxygen open.
Okay, you have it. The descent O2 is closed, bliss fill is open, and the ascent number 1 is open.
Very good, Ed, and stand by just a minute now. We'll get some ratings here. Okay, Al, and quantity looks good here, so we can turn ascent 02 off, ascent 02-1 to closed, push bill closed, and descent 02 back open.
Okay, that's done. Sounds good to us. Okay. Can we press on now?
Okay, you can press on. Thank you very much.
Houston Antares, we're depressing the cabin for jettison now.
Okay, Al, we're watching that, and it's looking good. Suits are looking good. Okay, Antares, could you verify chute release and auto, please?
Okay,
his ticket
release is now in auto. Okay, thank you, Al. Okay, this is about
Jefferson
now.
Roger, Al. You guys really registered the seismometer on those last ones.
That's good. Good heavy throw.
We're hoping you cleared the Velcro on those before you left.
Okay, Houston, EVA 2 post is through.
Okay, very good, Al.
Apollo Control, Houston, 137 hours, 12 minutes ground elapsed time. The crew of Antares are now stowing items for their later liftoff from the lunar surface.
Antares, Houston.
Jet,
troops on the ground here seem to think that the best place to stow that 100-foot tether would be over there in the left-hand stowage compartment.
Okay, we got quite a few things, I think, to stow here. We'll get with you and tell you where we're putting them.
Okay, very good.
This is Apollo Control, Houston, at 137 hours, 36 minutes, a ground elapsed time. Very quiet aboard Antares. Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell stowing the material and equipment that they have returned from the lunar surface aboard their landing craft. The next point in our flight plan, where we expect to hear more from them, will be the post-EVA debriefing. This perhaps 20 or 30 minutes away from this time. But for the present, the crew on Antares are preoccupied with their stowage and cabin cleanup. We're at 137 hours, 37 minutes, ground elapsed time, continuing to monitor. This is Apollo Control, Houston.
Antares, Houston?
Go ahead.
Okay, I hadn't heard from you in a while, Ed. Just wondering how things gone.
Well, we're pressing along here, Fred. We're pretty well along in our stowage. And if you look at the service checklist, we're at the top of the second column at bay 75.
Okay, very good, Al.
And we'll have a weight report of the location of all the stowage for you here momentarily.
Okay.
And then we'll probably eat, and then we'll probably rest for a while.
Sounds good.
Apollo Control, Houston, the ground elapsed time of 137 hours and 58 minutes. That was Fred Hayes speaking both with Ed Mitchell and Al Shepard. Our displays presently show a preliminary time for the liftoff of Antares, this at a ground elapsed time of 142 hours, 25 minutes, 39 seconds. With a delta V of 6,067.4 feet per second, this is planned to place Antares in an orbit of 52.2 nautical miles apalune, 9.2 nautical miles paralune. We're at 137 hours, 59 minutes, and this is Apollo Control, Houston.
Houston, Antares.
Go ahead, Al.
Are you planning on this TVA 2 debriefing, and if so, what time?
Okay, I guess whenever you're ready, Al. Do you happen to have any white jet cars on the Bronx?
Affirmative. We gave you the weights. We gave you the weights of the rocks that we put in the left-hand stowage yesterday. We have some additional rocks that are in the ISA. The total weight of the ISA is 50 pounds. The total weight of the SRC is 2 9-pounds. And we have a couple of large rocks in a sample bag on C-27, and that weight is 30 pounds.
Okay, Al, I copy that. It looks like a pretty good haul.
Yeah, sure does. And we'll be ready for debriefing in about another 10 minutes.
Okay, Al, just give us a call. We got some of the questions ready here. Anytime you're ready.
Okay, we'll give you a buzz, Rolly.
Okay, just wondered, are both of you still tied up with the stowage aside from the debrief? And we do have a little bit of a steerable comm check we need to get out of the way, and if you are free, Ed, maybe we could tackle that now.
Okay, Fred, we're ready to go with you here in just 1 second. If you have pads or anything you can work with me on before the debriefing, I'm ready to start.
Okay, I'll turn it over here to Joe, and he can read you up this little test they want to do on a steerable.
Roger, Terry, Joe, you read?
You bet, Ed. We're just getting switched around on the comm down here, and what we want to do, Ed, is to verify this acquisition and tracking capability. First thing we'd like to do is to go to the track mode switch to the SLU position and slowly rotate the pitch knob over the entire range and verify corresponding travel on the meters and also listen to the antenna driving if you can. After you've done that, we'll do the same thing with the yaw knob. So first of all, go track mode to SLU and rotate the pitch knob and see if you get corresponding travel and see if you can hear it rotate.
That's Joe Engel, the backup lunar module pilot, speaking to Ed Mitchell aboard Antares. We're at 138 hours, 43 minutes, ground elapsed time. This is Apollo Control Houston.
Houston, Antares.
Roger, Ed, go ahead.
Okay, I'm watching the antenna out the window, the shadow of it anyhow, and the needles, and it does drive over the entire range in both pitch and yaw. There's a great deal of lightly damped oscillation. It takes it quite a while to stabilize after you pick the particular setting of the thumb wheels, but it eventually gets there.
Okay, very good, Ed. Let's check the acquisition now. If you'll set the pitch to plus 120 and yaw to minus 38, and you're in SLU position, and verify that you get a signal strength greater than 3.
Okay, Joe, I've got a signal strength of 3.8.
3.8, okay, very good. Now go to auto and see if the signal strength comes up any. And also notice, if you will, if the pitch and yaw meters move any from your present position.
Okay, the signal strength stayed the same. And I'm indicating on the needles 130 and minus 40.
Okay, I understand. 130, 130, and minus 40.
Yep.
Okay, and now stand by.
In flight, Joe, if you'll remember it. Let me say that in flight, there were a couple of times it locked on beautifully. However, in order to get it to lock on, I had to get the main lobe up. It would not lock on with just having signal strength up around 3.2 or 3.4. I had to have signal strength up around 3.8 before I went to auto. Or if I went to auto with less than that, it just drove off and went to the stop. Several times, however, it locked up and was tracking very nicely, and then proceeded a few seconds later or a few minutes later to pop a antenna circuit breaker. So I think that it's overheating somewhere, and either that or some problem in the electronics that's causing it to pop circuit breakers.
Yeah, okay, that sounds like a pretty good analysis, Ed. And stand by just a second. We'll have a couple more little things to try here before we terminate this. Okay, Ed, now what we'd like to do is to, let me read this through before you do each step, but go back to the SLU position and set the pitch and yaw angles the same as what you're reading now on auto track at 130 and minus 40. And let's see, make sure we're in that position.
Okay, going to slew and selecting the thumb wheel position to match the needles.
Apollo Control, Houston. Now, what you're hearing is a communications checkout.
It's pretty close that time.
Okay, very good. Now, what we want you to do is to, while you're in slew position, drive the pitch control off, rotate the pitch control 8 degrees clockwise, and then go back track mode to auto and see if it will reacquire.
A
degrees clockwise.
A communications checkout involving S-band steerable antenna on Antares. This is Joe Engel in Mission Control speaking from the Capcom console. Ed Mitchell aboard Antares responding. We're at 138 hours, 49 minutes, ground elapsed time. This is a...
Come back at 8 degrees, Joe.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, let's go back to SLU and set the angles up again at 130 and minus 40, and we'll do the same thing with the yaw control. We'll rotate it 8 degrees clockwise and then back to auto and see if it'll track back.
Okay. Please come back in, Joe.
Okay, that's about all we can check, I guess, Ed. Let me give you a configuration that we'd like to go to in the event that we do have tracking problems during ascent, because we would like to maintain high bit rate if possible. Let me know when you have a pencil out and a card that you can copy it on. Maybe the AGS, your AGS card there would be a good place to have it. And for your information...
Okay, Joe, I'm ready.
Okay, very good. I was just going to say there's only 5 items here, so it won't be very much. We'd like, in the event you do lose steerable now, we'll go down voice backup, biomed left, audio mode to ICS push to talk, and to high bit rate. And, of course, then we'll want aft omni during the ascent.
Okay, I got 4 of them, Joe. The next and the last one, I guess, I don't have. Down voice backup, biomed left, high bit rate, and what's the next and the last one? Then aft omni.
Okay, audio mode to ICS push to talk, Ed.
Okay, ICS PTT.
Okay, very good. And that configuration is only in the event we lose tracking with the steerable.
Okay. Will do, Joe.
Okay, thank you. And I'll give you back to Fredo here. Stand by just a minute.
Command Antares Houston. We're standing by with the debriefing questions here whenever y'all are both ready to go.
Yeah, we're ready to go right now, Toto.
Okay. Okay, the first question is to describe texture or fracture patterns or any surface characteristics of the large boulders or the in the boulder field you were describing at Cone Crater.
You want textures and patterns of the boulders themselves?
That's affirmative, Mel.
Well, we made some remarks, as I recall, coming back down about the fact that they look weather-beaten, the fact that they maybe were fairly soft rocks, because they look very much like rocks that have been weather-beaten through the atmosphere. I think that was one of the types of textures that we noted. We noted other rocks that were very fine-grained, crystalline rocks, and essentially very smooth on the outside. We have a sample of one of those, football size. These are really the only two textures that I noticed. Did you notice any addition to that?
Well, no, I can't say that I did specifically. It wasn't really a matter of being able to describe what we saw in this particular case, because at that point we were so rushed that all we were trying to do was see different things and grab it without really noting how it necessarily differed. The only thing that I recall about these craters, or these boulders, was that there were inclusions or variations within the rock, and I assumed that they were crystals within the rock, right? It was a crystalline form within the rock. I don't know that that's true. They might have been, for example, a breccia, with stuff just a conglomerate in them, and I don't know whether that's true or not either. There simply wasn't time to look at them in that detail, so we just grabbed, photographed, and ran, and I'd be kind of at loss to give you an articulate description of really what those rocks are like.
I just think we have good samples of the two types that we saw on the west rim of the crater. Ed got a small piece of a light-colored rocks, and we actually brought back one that was typical of the other reddish-brown rocks.
Okay, yeah, very good.
I should say, okay.
Okay, the second question was, I guess, one that was asked somewhere along the way, and did you ever notice there being dust on tops of any of the boulders around Cone?
Let me make a stab at that, Fredo. I noticed some of the rocks, the smaller boulders, that were closer to the ground were covered with dust. But I recall boulders that were not covered with dust. And for example, the boulders out here closer to the limb, the last boulder field I went to, did not have any appreciable dust on those rocks. And the white ones that I sampled up near Cone Crater did not have any appreciable dust on them. However, others did. As a matter of fact, there was one of the boulders in that group of the white boulders that I photographed for you, but it was too big to do anything with. It had brown and white, and I couldn't tell what kind of a contact it was. Whether the white part was because it had been broken away, or whether it was a contact of two different materials. It was just, there just wasn't time to investigate that sort of phenomena, so we tried to simply sample the two types and photograph it. But as far as dust is concerned, I think we've seen both, and among the larger boulders, there are certainly a large number that do not have any dust on them.
Okay.
Yeah, that's generally true. I think we probably would have been aware of dust. I think that's generally true, that we probably would have been aware of dust. There certainly was a lot of filleting, and we tried to document that for you, but I would say, generally speaking, there was no dust on any of the on the surface of any of the rocks that we saw.
Roger, Al. And the next question, when you were high on the slopes there of Cone, could you tell any differences in the surface color tone when you looked back in the area to the south and to southwest?
Well, of course, the obvious differences in the bright craters, those are always noticeable, and those were there. Beyond that, I wasn't aware of any marked contrast in color tones.
Well, I don't know whether it's a figment of my imagination or not. I always noted going up there this morning, or thought I noted, that the area around Old Nameless was, there were some darker patches, but we were so preoccupied with finding our way to the top of Cone Crater that I neither observed it or made remarks about that observation, nor really observed it that much more closely.
Roger, Ed. Hopefully, maybe the pans will pick that up. Okay, next question. This is for Ed. When you attempted the second triple core, and I think you really answered this in real time, but just to get it straight, did you think you hit another rock, like you mentioned bedrock, on the first attempt, or did it just get progressively harder to drive?
Well, I wasn't quite sure, but I thought that I'd hit rock again. But when I pulled it out, it could very well have been just a compaction type of phenomenon where it just quit driving. And I don't know the answer. It felt like in driving it that I'd hit something pretty solid, but it wasn't as though I'd hit a very sharp line of rock, as opposed to soft material. It went down fairly well, and then it tightened up, and then it just stopped.
Okay. To back up a little further back in time, we missed when the double core was task was done. About how far could you push the tube down before you started hammering? Okay, Ed, we lost you there for a little bit. I guess you can, if you get it locked on, just leave it in slow rather than auto.
That's where you are.
Okay, I didn't get the answer there, Ed, on how far that double core got manually pushed in before you started hammering on it.
I'll have to answer that, and I didn't put it in.
Are you talking about the first one, Fred?
That's the firm, Al.
Okay, the double core that I took in the vicinity of point A went in perhaps 2 to 2.5 to 3 inches, no more than 3 inches.
Roger. Can I find the next question? This answer will probably...
If they went that far, I'd be surprised, the ones I took.
Okay, Ed. The question five is kind of the same as the first one, and I assume your answer will probably be the same, but... the question is, could you describe in any more detail, and I guess it's really saying, did you think you saw any stratigraphy at all in the way the ejecta was laying around the cone crater?
I saw a couple of boulders that I thought had some stratigraphy in them, but...
Certainly was not, you know, obviously a classic sip, but there was, well, as a matter of fact, we took a sample from one. It looked like an instant stratigraphy unit on the way back down. We grabbed a quick sample from one. It didn't jump out and become obvious, however. Okay, and a little bit, everything here especially seems to be pretty darn subtle. And I'm convinced there was stratigraphy there because we saw suggestions of it. Just like I'm convinced I see some lineations out here or some suggestions of them. But they don't jump out and hit you in the face. And we'd probably have to go over the photographs and talk about each one of these samples in detail before we can really bring out the picture on it. I just can't remember a lot of those very subtle things.
Okay, and I assume on a little bit larger scale, you couldn't detect anything with respect to the hinge flap type relation in that boulder field around cone.
No, we sure couldn't see that at all. I'm sure it was there if we just had time, but we couldn't see it.
Okay. And this one is for Al. About how deep were you down in, with the trench, Al, when the side walls started caving in?
Well, actually, the first cut I took was down to about 6 inches, and there was some caving at that time. The side walls were then at probably about 70 to 80 degrees. The next cut I took made the walls a little more steep, closer to the vertical, perhaps 80, 85. And at that point, they started coming down. Fine grain regolith at the top of the cut just to tumble down into the trench.
Okay. And I guess I ask you in real time the thickness of the intermediate layer, but they'd also like to know if you have any estimate on the thickness of the very top layer.
I sure don't. It wasn't, they say, stratigraphy in the classic sense because it all started to crumble after the first couple of strokes. That was a place where you had took a sample of some light-colored material. It was very close to the surface.
The upper layer that you're talking about, the brown, and the next one in the white, it seemed to, the brown seemed to be showing the white in some places after an inch or 2 inches. I'm not sure it's another layer, but it had to be. I can't find another explanation for it, but it seemed to be very thin, 1 or 2 inches at the top layer.
I think that's probably a pretty good call. I'd say maybe 2 inches. And of course, we had that thin layer of fairly glassy material, which I collected, and then the bottom whiter material. material, which Ed got a sample of, as well as the ones I took.
Okay, and you've already answered the next part of this question, which was distinction between layers. You had both color and textural distinctions there that told you you had the layering. And I guess the last part maybe you've answered too, but it's questioning whether the wall caving, you think maybe was a natural event, or do you think it was due to dragging the trenching tool through the cut?
Well, I'm not sure I had an unnatural shovel. And I'm not quite sure what the question is now that I think back about it again, but you mean that...
I thought you answered that, Al, because you... Your previous comment indicated that it started caving in with your first stroke, and if that was true, then it looks like the trenching tool helped bring the walls down.
Well, I'm sure that it did. And actually, it was on about the second stroke where it started to occur, because the first drag through was the walls were less steep. But I'm sure the tool had a lot to do with it.
Okay, the next question, when we were sort of quickly passing by North Triplet Crater on the way back to Antares, you mentioned in passing there coming upon a little boulder field. And the question is, do you think this boulder field was tied in some way to North Triplet, possibly part of a ray?
I recall that we inferred they were boulders. I think that we thought they were a field of ejected material from that particular crater. And therefore, we took some samples there. Is that the spot you're referring to?
Yeah, that's it, Al.
Yeah, if we inferred they were boulders, that was incorrect. They were just hand samples and perhaps up to 8 to 10 inches, but all lumped together as though they'd been ejected from that crater and right on our path. And we took a couple samples from that area.
As a matter of fact, there were boulders, which we also thought came out of probably the same area, but there wasn't anything around the boulders that seemed small enough and obvious enough to grab in the, on the run like we tried to do with this bunch of samples.
Okay. The next question is, did you see any evidence of downslope creep with respect to the cone crater fillets you saw on the uphill side of rocks?
Yeah, I did, and I'm not so sure. But what part of the delineation that I was talking about would not be found on cone in a circular around the crater now? I saw these same things up there, and I described them before, so I didn't say anything about it again. But my guess is that they go circular around Cone Crater. Now, that may be entirely wrong.
You mean sort of like contour lines, Ed?
Except probably for direction. That's what I'm suggesting, but it's merely a suggestion, and I didn't follow them out, and I didn't check them that closely to be able to prove it. But where I did see them, they were indeed kind of parallel to the slope. I mean, parallel to the rim of the crater. In other words, around the crater.
Very good, Ed. Next question. the difficulty you had at the last there, climbing up to Cone Rim, was that due primarily to the terrain slope, or did the soil conditions change again that made cause you have some greater problems?
I think probably both. I think we just entirely underestimated the difficulty of going that far and getting that high in such a short period of time. It's a darn hard climb to try to do rapidly, and the soil's a little bit thin and mushy, and the suits are bulky. It's all those problems rolled in, Fred. We just, it was too ambitious, I guess.
Let me say that I don't really think that the composition of the soil changed very much. As a matter of fact, that was one thing that struck me about the whole area. The consistency of the texture of the regolith outside of soft areas, of course, which came crater rim. I think as far as the progress up there is concerned, it was due to the grade and the boulders and the rocks that we had to go around. But really, as far as the surface texture is concerned, as far as the bearing strength of the surface, I thought that outside of the crater rims that it was unusually consistent all the way through. And the thing that surprised me was the pattern of the raindrop pattern with these very small surface pebbles, which is entirely different than we have down here in this area where we've landed.
Yeah, I think we remarked on the similarity of the surface. I think I remarked at one spot that it seemed to be getting a little harder up there, but that seemed to have been isolated. It wasn't true in general, just it seemed to be in that one local area. And certainly, as Al pointed out, the softest areas, by and large, are crater rims, are fairly fresh crater rims. And when you run it through one of those, you get some fairly soft material. But otherwise, it's about like you saw here near the limb on television, the way we were pressing into that.
Roger. The next question is how abundant and what was the distribution of glass that you saw around on the surface, or I guess in one case you mentioned it draped on a rock?
Yeah, we went roaring past one rock that had some, well, what looked like glass splatter. I'm pretty sure that it was. And I'm sure there are other samples of that out here, but we did not see them. That was really the only example of glass that I could positively identify, or come close to positively identify as being glass, per se. There are some crystalline rocks out here, and I'm sure we got some samples of them for you.
Yeah, I concur with that. I was surprised that we didn't obviously see more glass. A lot of the smaller rocks that we did pick up that were sample size were so darn dirty that they may have glass in them. But they're just covered with this dirt, which clings to everything. And why the big rocks, the big boulders, as you asked about earlier, are not covered the same way, I don't know. Maybe some of them are. But it really covers up what the rock is made of. And it probably obscured a lot of glass that we just didn't see.
Okay, we need to make a quick comm switch here, Ed. We're having trouble staying with you from Madrid. I'd like you to go from FM to PM.
You got it.
Okay, how do you read now? Okay, that was the reason for our comm loss a little while back on the steerable. The next question here, actually, let's see, second 10, did you notice the dust adhering to the Met particularly, and if so, what parts?
If you got a direct hit with mud, with this dust, Fred, if it's sprayed on something, it seems to stick. It just covers everything. And I'm looking down out the window at the Met. Surprisingly enough, it doesn't look too bad. The fenders, the wheels, the lower parts, the legs, yeah, they're pretty covered with dirt. And there's quite a bit spread up, it's splattered around a little bit. But it looks surprisingly good, as a matter of fact. Maybe it's because it just doesn't have enough porous surface.
Okay, Ed. One more question here. You mentioned seeing blocks around the rim of North Triplet. Did you happen to get a look far enough down there to see if you also saw either blocks or ray patterns from center Triplet crater?
Fredo, it's so darn undulating here. That was part of our problem. We couldn't even see Central Triplet Crater. We knew it was there, but you could walk in some of these undulations and get lost from each other if you're not careful. You just can't find where you are. And we couldn't see anything from Central Triplet and know it was from that.
Okay, and I guess one last question here to clear up what ended up in the SCSC out of the bottom of the trench. The question, this is for Al, did you primarily end up with fine-grained or coarse-grained material in the SCSC?
It's all fine-grained material. Some of it is from the surface. And unfortunately, when I opened the first canister, the seal came off the canister in the bottom, so I had to go back and regroup and get another one, take another sample. But I think that I got mostly from the bottom of the crater, the bottom of the trench. However, it is all fine grained, so nothing of any greater size.
Okay, that's about it. Thank you very much. Guess you can think about getting breakfast now.
Okay. Thank you. It was a good... Okay, that was a good job of getting us sorted out there when we got behind the timeline. We appreciate that help.
Well, we thank you again for doing a great job, Al. And Ed, I think we picked up everything we needed there.
Yeah, I hope so. It sure was a panic from our point of view.
Well, we kind of knew that before we got there.
Things we like to have done. Yeah, I think you're right, Fredo. There were so many things we'd like to have done, so many things to do, so many interesting things to look at here, and we didn't even have a chance to scratch the surface. We hope we brought back something that you can sort out as time goes on.
Well, it's a little better than that sand pile out back of the training building anyway, though, isn't it?
Oh, man.
Don't you know it.
It really is. It's fantastic up here.